Welcome to this episode of Bioethics for the People, the most popular podcast on the planet, according to Grandma Nancy. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Tyler Gibb, who, if he weren't here recording right now, would probably be golfing.
And I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Devin Stahl, who dutifully completes the same 5 New York Times puzzles every day.
All right, good morning, Tyler.
Good morning.
So it is a new year, a new topic. Are you excited?
Yeah, I am excited. I love the new year. I love it when the year rolls over and people start thinking about resolutions and start thinking about goals and stuff like that. I think it's like a really refreshing time. I don't like that it's in the middle of cold winter in the middle of Michigan, but I like New Year's, new topics, new year, new us, new me.
Yeah, new me, full of water. This was one of my New Year's resolutions, which you can't see because it's a podcast.
Holy smokes.
This is a 64-ounce water bottle that I'm trying to drink every day.
It looks like it's issued by the military
it's
as well.
It's legit. And it has, well, and here's how you know it's not issued by the military. It has cute little, like, motivating phrases on it.
At each level that you drink down, it's like almost
Absolutely.
There. Good job. What
it's
does it say?
Rise and shine. Let's get started. Remember your goal. Keep it up.
Oh, man. What's the last one?
The last one is all in a day's work.
Oh, that's very affirming.
So affirming.
Yeah. I don't think that that would motivate me. I think I would be annoyed by it mostly.
No, I love a good motivator slogan, but mostly I just like carting this thing around and everybody going, wow, that's quite the water bottle. So Tyler, I have a question for you.
Sure.
How do you decide? I had a new group of students this semester coming in and they always want to ask me, how do you decide what to research and what to write about?
Oh, that's a great question. I think for me, I was actually having this conversation with one of my students actually just yesterday. They were starting a new elective with me, and I told them that I think probably 70 or 80% of what I end up writing and publishing comes from clinical ethics consultation questions or questions that students are like, hey, Dr. Gibb, have you ever thought about blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, no, I haven't. Let's get into it. So most of it is from either clinical ethics cases or students asking insightful questions.
Ooh, that's like, I bet the students feel really good about that too. Like, I'm going to ask the best question so that Dr. Gibb has to do research on my question.
Yeah. It's good for them because if they ask me the question, then I try really hard to include them in the research and writing process and the publication process. Mm-hmm. And so I do publish quite often. If you look at my CV, I have zero publications where I'm a sole author. It's always with other folks, so usually students or residents.
Yeah, that's awesome for them. Okay, so that's 60 to 70%. Yeah. I agree, except maybe I don't get as many student prompts. Uh-huh. But mostly my students are undergraduates, so they do ask really good questions, but not typically the kinds of questions where I'm like, whoa, no one's ever thought of that before, because mm-hmm. they're just really new to the topic.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, yeah, it's clinical ethics or I hear about cases in the news sometimes, mm-hmm. Like where discrimination has happened or somebody says something that seems kind of outlandish that happened to them in the clinical setting. So a lot of it's that. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes requests. I get a lot of requests to especially for like book chapters, like, hey, we're writing a book about this. Would you contribute a chapter on, and then they name what they think is my specialty. And so that can be rewarding too, because it's like, oh, and then it's usually stuff I already know something about.
Yep.
So then it's a little bit easier.
Yeah. There is a small subset of publications that come about based purely on other goals. So sometimes I get asked what really want to go to a conference, for example. And sometimes I finagle my way in that way. How about you? Have you ever done that?
Well, since you mention it, yes, I have. Every now and again, you get invited somewhere really cool, like say overseas, and on the condition, and they'll pay for it, on the condition that you deliver a talk on whatever that conference is about. And, you know, sometimes it's like right up your alley. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a little bit less, but for some reason they wanted to invite you anyway. Mm-hmm. And that can be awesome. But it does take a little bit of extra research. So That's a nice segue into our new topic for this season is going to be AI in medicine, which seems to be a really hot topic right now. AI is kind of taking over everything, and thinking about the ethics of AI is really important. And so I got invited to a conference on human dignity and AI.
Okay.
And they said, would you talk about medicine? Because in their minds, medicine is one of the arenas in which there's actually really optimistic and really promising advances in AI that could improve people's health.
Yeah. That's great. I don't know that I've ever been invited specifically with in that way. It's usually I want to go to the conference and I try to craft my proposal or the research that I'm proposing to do in order to justify going. I had a really good presentation, a panel that I was on in at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland that I had to bone up on Adam Smith. Adam Smith is usually known as a political philosopher and economics, but he does have this really kind of long book about moral philosophy. So we finagled Adam Smith into our proposal.
The invisible hand of healthcare in the marketplace?
Kind of.
Something like
that. Yeah. It was a little bit of a stretch, but it was a good trip to Scotland with some really close colleagues, good friends. So.
Absolutely. So sometimes it ends up being, you know, okay, maybe I wouldn't have done this otherwise, but I got this cool trip. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it was sort of, for me, I got invited to Oxford and it was like, well, this is something I should know about anyway, because this is all the rage.
Yeah.
This might very well transform healthcare the way we know it. And I should at least basically understand what's going on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. AI, it's everywhere. And I mean, it's one of those things that it's not going to go away. I don't think. And so people who are resistant to it, trying to ignore its presence and its influence, I think are, it's kind of wrongheaded. I think everybody who is engaged either in education, academia, research, healthcare, I think all of those areas that we kind of live in, I think AI is transformative in a lot of ways. So I'm excited about this season and this topic and talking about AI with people who know way more about it than me.
Yeah.
I'm really good at using ChatGPT to write haikus and limericks though.
Just abysmal. All right. Well, okay. So I've just been doing some really basic research on the ways in which AI is already being integrated into clinical care. And so I thought we would just discuss some of those ways. So don't ask me super technical questions about exactly how it works. In fact, I don't know that there might be only a handful of people who really understand how AI works. Mm-hmm. There's a black box problem we could talk about. But so this is just kind of like my preliminary research talking about the multiple ways in which we're basically already using AI in healthcare, and maybe we didn't even know it. So are you ready? It's just kind of like a countdown list.
It's kind of like a survey of the field.
Survey of the, exactly.
The landscape. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
So place number one, AI in diagnostics and treatment planning.
Okay.
How good are doctors at diagnosing people?
I think they are very well-intentioned and not, I mean, I think for, I want to be careful because I know how many clinicians listen to this, but I think for a lot of diagnoses, doctors are really, really good. Mm-hmm. But I think that sometimes healthcare providers, whether it's a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner or a physician of any specialty, I think that there's a lot of overstating, overbelief, maybe false confidence in diagnostic accuracy. Mm-hmm. So room for improvement, I would say. Room for improvement.
Sure, it could be. And I think no physician would argue that they're like a perfect diagnostician and they can never use help with leveraging data, right? Mm-hmm. So of course, physicians already do this. They look to the data to see kind of like what would be the symptoms that would help you understand a potential diagnosis. So in some ways, this isn't brand new. But the promise of AI is that it will leverage big data to improve diagnostic assessment. And then hopefully then that leads to better outcomes for patients if they're diagnosed earlier and more accurately. We're talking about large language models. So they're basically combing all the data from medical charts and figuring out like what kinds of symptoms correlate with what kinds of diagnoses that are accurate. Mm-hmm. And it's really good. You've probably heard about this, but it's already being used to read medical images.
Mm. So like for radiology, mm-hmm. MRIs, x-rays, stuff like that.
Yeah. So if you can train it to sort of see like cancer or other kinds of things that you could only see in like a mammography, it's reading the mammography with the radiologist to try to improve cancer detection. And there's some stuff saying that it's better at seeing things earlier, which of course for cancer care is super important. The faster you can catch cancer, usually the more likely you are to be able to treat it. That seems good. ECG abnormalities, so if somebody has a cardiovascular event, you could use AI to sort of read the echocardiogram, and it has been shown to already predict kind of what kinds of cardiovascular events could be more deadly. And so again, earlier detection of those things. Some fertility specialists are using AI to choose embryos with the highest chances of achieving successful pregnancy.
Hmm.
So it can look at embryos and help you pick the one that's most likely to implant and lead to a successful birth.
And this is all using massive data, like you said, right? So it's using basically the experience of all healthcare providers over like whatever records we have to improve the precise diagnosis of this patient that's sitting in front of us.
Yeah. So it's just gathering large amounts of data, which might come with some ethical questions about what people are agreeing to. But for now, let's just say the outcomes of that seem to be positive. So this could be a really, you know, promising area for AI in healthcare.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be really hard to argue against better diagnostic outcomes, right?
Right.
I mean, nobody's going to say, oh, I wish I weren't diagnosed sooner, or I wish I weren't diagnosed with more accuracy.
Yeah, although, and we'll get to this in just a second, people don't love the idea of their physicians relying on AI to help diagnose or make treatment plans. So people still are pretty wary of this. So let's get to that in just a second. But let's say, okay, so these are the kinds of diagnostic uses. Right now, AI is not replacing physicians to do diagnoses, but is usually added as like an additional layer of detection.
Mm-hmm.
And some have suggested this would be really good for pivotal points in a physician's schedule where they're experiencing fatigue in their mental processes. So physicians tend to work for a really long time, and there are times in which they miss stuff because they're just exhausted. I'm sure no physicians listening to this have ever experienced that, but.
Right. Yeah. So maybe it's an even more effective or more useful tool later in a shift, for example, if you've been sitting in the basement of a radiology office and reading scans for 8 or 10 hours in a row.
Yeah.
I can see that.
So there's this idea that like, okay, when you're faltering, when your human mind, your simple, simple human mind gets tired, unlike a machine, this might be a good point to say, okay, I'm going to run my diagnosis past this AI model to see if it's giving me the same thing that I'm suspecting.
Yeah.
So like a kind of decision fatigue aid. And maybe that's like a gradual way to sort of like enter it into the physician's repertoire of tools that they might want to use when doing clinical care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That seems less problematic, I think, for a lot of people. I think if my doctor was at the end of his or her or their shift and they were using an AI tool to help improve their accuracy, I think I'd be okay with that.
So here's what I found. There is some promising results from reading diagnostic tests and sort of providing additional information. It tends to be that when physicians are incorporating these diagnostic aids, it doesn't necessarily make them better at diagnosing because they're much more likely to choose their own diagnosis than the AI diagnosis, which is interesting.
Yeah, some confirmation bias.
Yeah, so we'll see. So it seems like physicians are not totally on board with using this tool. So we'll see how that progresses.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay. So AI can also be used for treatment planning. Again, the same kind of idea is that, okay, once you have a diagnosis, you need to figure out the best kind of treatment plan for that particular diagnosis. And again, by combing huge amounts of data to see what has worked for other people that seem to have a similar profile as the patient in front of you, you could come up with a better treatment plan for that patient, a more successful one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like more tailored to this individual.
Exactly.
I can see this being useful, particularly in really complicated treatment plans, like multi-phase cancer stuff, for example.
Same kind of idea. I would think, man, if it improved the success of my treatment plan, how could I possibly be upset that the physician was using AI for that? Mm-hmm. But Americans on the whole believe that the use of AI to diagnose and recommend treatments will worsen the doctor-patient relationship. So what how do you feel about that?
Interesting. Well, let's try to understand that. So the concern is that it will worsen the doctor-patient relationship I'm struggling to try to think of which ways it would decrease that relationship. Maybe less trust, or maybe the doctor would feel less obligated to really build that relationship and get into the entire life story or medical history of the patient if they feel like they can just plug it into an AI and get the same outcome, maybe?
Yeah, I think so this was a Pew study from 2023 that said 60% of patients are uncomfortable with the idea of their healthcare provider relying on AI and that they think it would worsen their relationship. And it didn't sort of, you know, this is a big Pew study, so it didn't sort of delve into exactly why people would feel that way. But I think that's a good suspicion is, you know, the way that my doctor can diagnose and treat me is by knowing something about me. So understanding my history and that kind of exchange forms a relationship. But if all my doctor has to do is go into my medical chart, click AI diagnosis, you know, she doesn't have to talk to me about that ahead of time. Yeah. Right? So that kind of bonding relationship might be severed if in this, you can imagine a scenario in which the doctor doesn't even need to know me, like doesn't even need to meet me in order to diagnose me. And that might feel not great on the patient side.
Yeah, and that kind of questions the role of the physician anyway. So I don't view my physician as somebody I just go to for treatment plans or for diagnoses, right? Mm-hmm. They provide advice, they provide encouragement, they provide, sometimes it's, they help me think through things sometimes about my own health. And so there's a lot more than just the diagnosis treatment aspect of it. So maybe that's what that's getting at.
That's right. Yeah, we don't go to robots. Like, I mean, a lot of us go to the internet first before we go to our physician.
Right.
Me, never. I would never try to self-diagnose. But we usually don't stop there. Even if we thought, which is probably inaccurate, that, you know, the internet could give us a good diagnosis, we want to talk to somebody, some professional, who's going to form a relationship with us and be there with us through whatever tough situations might come. So, yeah, I can see why. I don't think that's a ridiculous fear amongst patients to think that this could damage that relationship between the physician and the patient.
Yeah.
So that just it might be irresponsible to totally offload decision making to AI, even if AI is better or more accurate in diagnosis and treatment planning. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's topic number one, maybe the least controversial. Like there's still ethical issues here, but for the most part, I think most bioethicists would say, yeah, if AI can help us do better in diagnosing and treatment planning, that seems like a fairly good use of AI.
Yeah.
Here's another one, and these might get progressively more controversial.
Okay.
Risk and conversation nudging. Have you heard of this?
No, not specifically in terms of, I think I understand kind of what it means, but why don't you just explain it to me?
Yeah. So a lot of healthcare systems are now using AI to nudge physicians to have conversations with their patients regarding like either their risk for developing or contracting a disease or their mortality risk.
Okay. So basically the tool will prompt the doctor to talk about different things that may be coming or different issues that might develop based upon that particular patient's profile?
Right. So, for example, I don't know about your experience, but my experience is that physicians are not great at predicting mortality. Like physicians, at least in the literature, it seems to be that physicians kind of, depending on their specialty, some kind of underestimate and some kind of overestimate, but that it's really hard. And physicians will say it's really hard to prognosticate mortality.
Yep.
So a AI algorithm could conceivably, and is already in some healthcare systems, combing records, again, using big data to comb records to show a patient profile where it says a patient who meets, you know, your patient's profile is likely to die in the next 12 months. Flag, you should have a conversation about end of life care planning.
Yeah. I mean, that seems super helpful. Particularly if you have not comorbidities, but a number of different health issues that in isolation are hard to connect the dots about how that impacts overall mortality or development of other types of illnesses. I can see that being super helpful.
Yeah, and in reporting on this, the it tends to be the physicians who already are having those end-of-life conversations find this kind of nudging helpful, because they might, some of them said, hey, there were patients who I thought I would not have flagged myself as potentially having 12 months or less to live, but the machine did it, and it caused me to think, oh, maybe this is a patient who conceivably could die within the year, and we should have some important end-of-life conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That can be super. I can see that being really helpful, particularly when we're talking about advanced care planning, or maybe getting someone's ducks in a row towards the end of their life, you know, maybe repairing, revisiting relationships or financial questions, or I can see how that could be very useful.
Yeah, all sorts of, I think you and I would agree, all sorts of really important work can happen in the last year, 6 months, month mm-hmm. of life. And if you don't know that you're dying, you don't start doing that work, right? Mm-hmm. So lots of good work can happen, but you got to know that you're dying, which is why physicians should tell patients that they can at least conceive of the idea that they could die within a year. You know, and no one's ever perfect. You always meet patients who are like, oh, they told me I only had a year left to live, and now it's 10 years later. So, mm-hmm. you know, they weren't very good at that. So you have to like kind of couch it in, we don't know for sure, but. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but my guess is that the physicians who already are good at end of life, you know, conversations could use this. The ones who never want to talk about that are the ones who could use this kind of nudging the most. Will they adopt it? Hard to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at least it's, you know, maybe the prompt will get them thinking about having those kinds of conversations.
Yeah.
A slightly more controversial use in nudging would be things like your profile meets the criteria for somebody who's really likely to contract HIV.
Okay.
So just imagine being told by your physician, hey, Tyler, because of your lifestyle and because of your health choices, our AI algorithm says that you're really likely to contract HIV. Here's some preventative methods for not getting HIV.
Mm. Yeah, that feels different. but not just HIV or other type of infectious diseases, I would imagine as well. Mm-hmm. I guess that's my question. What other things besides HIV does it prognosticate risk factors of? Death, HIV, there's got to be more.
The two I found that are more about like disease were cancers and HIV. So those were the two that seemed to be like the ones where the conversation nudging is already happening. You can imagine for all sorts of, you know, COVID or bird flu or anything coming down the pike, it could be really helpful for. But there's, especially with contracting diseases that are stigmatized, you can imagine that is a really tough conversation.
Yeah, yeah. So the tool will be used to nudge the doctor to begin or have these or initiate these conversations that they otherwise, for a variety of reasons, good and bad, would be reluctant to start that conversation. Is that what you mean?
Yep, exactly.
Good.
So these are already difficult conversations to have, both end-of-life conversations. You're at high risk for cancer. You're at high risk for HIV. These are, I mean, nobody wants to have those conversations. Nobody's gleeful to have a conversation like that. These are tough conversations. So this is just a kind of nudge to say, maybe you should start this conversation. I don't know how it nudges. In my mind, it's like, doc, you're amazing at your job. Have you thought that maybe patient X might want to have a conversation about blah, 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 because according to the data, they're at high risk for blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I don't know if the algorithm sweet talks you like that or not.
I bet you can get it to do that. So on my account for ChatGPT, I changed the voice. So it's much more, it's a, kind of a more maternal, directive voice than it is. Kind of more than Siri, for example. It's a completely different voice. So yeah, maybe if you have those nudges come in a very sweet, encouraging, empathetic voice, that maybe that would improve it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a couple ethical challenges that might arise in this kind of prompting. So maybe less so on the end of life conversation, but in the, you know, you're at high risk for a certain kind of disease. There's, of course, like, what does it mean that a patient profile is prompting a kind of conversation about a stigmatized disease like HIV? That's tough. And then are we profiling people in a weird way? Like, because, you know, you meet this kind of demographic, you know, that might feel like a weird conversation. But also there's conversation around like, what if, it's one thing if there's like mitigation strategies that you can employ that are really successful, right? So, you know, there definitely are for things like HIV, but certain kind of cancers, it's like, you know, there's really nothing you can do to prevent this, and there's almost nothing you can do to treat it. Like I'm thinking like pancreatic cancer is really hard to treat. So if I told you you're high risk for a cancer like that, what would you do with that information?
I mean, if there's nothing that I can do about my lifestyle or my choices or obviously my genetic predisposition to cancers, then I mean, there's nothing you can do. Then it's just merely added worry or added concern or added stress to my life that I can't do anything about.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you'd go in for like cancer screenings all the time. Not everybody dies of pancreatic cancer, but it's the mortality rate's really high. So maybe if you were constantly being screened and they caught it really early, your chances of not dying would be higher. But there are some things that you just imagine, like there's only so much preventative work we can do and there's only so much treatment we can do. And maybe this is stuff you just wouldn't want to know. Like it would make you so anxious.
Yeah.
So there would be some conversation around that. Like what's really actually helpful to know about risk?
Yeah. What's the benefit of having that? More information isn't always beneficial.
Yeah, and then can our healthcare system take people getting constantly screened for cancers that they're at high risk for? Maybe a different question about the system, but.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, so maybe there's like a little bit more controversy in some of that nudging. Here's one that maybe you saw written about. This was a issue of the American Journal of Bioethics brought this up recently. Predicting patient decision-making.
Okay. So trying to predict what clinical decisions the patient or their proxy, assuming a surrogate, are actually going to make?
Especially in the case that the patient becomes incapacitated. So the patient loses decision-making capacity, and now we're trying to guess what they would have wanted. So either we, meaning the surrogate, or we, meaning the clinical team, is trying to guess what this patient would have wanted because they can no longer tell us what they would want.
Right, which is very difficult. Even for people who know the patient very, very well, the accuracy of decisions made by a surrogate or by a proxy, even a very close family member, are not very good.
We're not great at predicting this. Like you said, even if we know. So ideally, you've had the conversation about this exact scenario with a loved one, with a caretaker, and they're just been sort of enacting that. Less ideal is something like, oh, we've never had the conversation, but I know the kind of person that they are, and I can maybe predict what they would have wanted. Even less ideal is like, they never told me, I have no idea, we never talked about this sort of thing, I'm totally in the dark, which is super stressful on families, right?
Yeah, and very common, particularly in sudden end-of-life situations facing an unexpected death. The number of people who have had that conversation in that level of detail that is clinically useful is very low and very narrow.
And even worse, sometimes we have patients who are unrepresented. There's nobody to speak on their behalf. And at least in Texas, then we can have a physician make medical decisions for them, as long as that physician isn't treating them. But what does that person know about this? So they're just doing a, like, I don't know, what is in their best interest, quote unquote, best interest. Like, what do we think a reasonable person would want in this scenario? That's a, these are really tough decisions.
Yeah, all kinds of problems with that form of decision making. But also not a lot of other options, a lot of other frameworks and how to make decisions for somebody that you don't have any, very, very little information about.
Yeah, so how could you, how do you imagine you could use AI for this?
I mean, I guess you would put in, so if you could predict what, I guess, I don't know, is it trying to establish what a reasonable patient would choose in that particular scenario based upon massive amounts of other decisions in similar situations?
Maybe. So, yeah, so one kind of way of modeling this would be like, what do patients typically choose who meet this patient's profile? And that could, and then you have to decide like what kind of demographics seem important. Like, is it important? Is their age important? Is their race important? Is their gender important? Is their economic status important? I mean, all that feels a little bit icky.
Yeah. And of all those things that you just mentioned, I personally, and this is probably just my delusion, but I don't think that those are the primary deciding characteristics of a lot of decisions that I make, I think. Particularly like in a healthcare setting, but also how individuals make medical decisions is kind of this also kind of black box that is super interesting. But I don't, that feels, I don't like that one as much.
Not great. You'll feel way better about this then. What if What if instead I comb your social media?
Nope.
And pass. All the things you've ever put on the internet and your browser history, and I compile that into a decision maker, a Tyler decision maker. Mm. And what if it's actually really accurate?
I don't know that accuracy is the main thing that I care about right there. Yeah, that feels worse because then it's so this is a bigger question about all of AI, not just in healthcare, but what type of data is being put into the soup, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that any of those things that you mentioned would, in my mind, provide more insight into what type of person or decisions or values that I hold, particularly not my browser history.
I won't ask what's in your browser history, yeah. But
it's a lot about golf swings, golf swing.
Yeah, so there's like two kinds of questions here, maybe three. So one is like, would that be accurate? So it's just a kind of data question, an empirical question. Would your browser history and your social media be the kind of data that we could pull that mm-hmm. would actually accurately predict your decisions in healthcare? You know, mm-hmm. it seems like that those are really different kinds of selves. Mm-hmm. You know, like my internet self maybe does not well represent my real life self or my decision-making self in different contexts. Mm-hmm. That's one kind of question, which is actually potentially an empirical question, right? So we could really test this. Yeah. We could do all that work, we could have the output, and then I could just ask you, mm-hmm. independent of that, what would you choose? And then we could compare the choices.
Yeah.
So whether or not that's super accurate, there's claims in which we think that some people think it could be in ways that are really subtle and you don't want to acknowledge. Like mm-hmm. The idea that my browser history and my social media would accurately predict my healthcare decisions just feels kind of like icky, even if it's true. Mm-hmm. But then is that what we ought to be doing? Like, is that the kind of data that even if it is accurately predicting that we should be combing to get a patient profile? Mm-hmm. That's a different kind of question. Like, that's a values question. Is this data that that we should be using? Mm-hmm. And then there's the question of like, what is the purpose of a surrogate, right? So if you do have a surrogate, is the purpose of a surrogate to make perfect decisions exactly as you would have made them? Which is a way we talk about surrogate decision making in healthcare, right? Substituted decision making, where we do sort of acknowledge that like the point of that decision maker is to make the decisions the patient would have made. But then there's also something about your loved one and your relationship with them making decisions for you that also seems important. It's not just about accuracy, it's about mm-hmm. relationality.
Yeah, I mean, that raises the question about what type of data is being put in. So if it's being put into the soup, so if it's social media activity, if it's browser history, that stuff can all be useful, I guess. But a lot of my decision-making is based upon, like you said, the relationship or the impact that that decision has on other relationships, whether it's relationships with colleagues or relationships with my wife or with my kids or, you know, extended family or other people that I care about. Yeah, and all of that is like this really murky, moving, almost like intuitive gestalt about how I make decisions, I think, which I can't imagine that all being captured in even the best of an AI world, but...
We'll see. There's more research on this being done, so I guess we will see. Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on. The next domain is something about administrative efficiency.
Mm.
Okay. So,
counting coppers.
Exactly. The average primary care visit, do you know how long people typically meet with their primary care physician?
I know they're scheduled for usually 15 minutes, so 7.5? I don't know.
Well, actually, so that might be true in the hospital, but if you're just in an outpatient sort of situation, they will budget about 30 minutes. So the average patient will meet with their primary care physician for their, you know, annual checkup or whatever for about 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. The physician who does primary care will spend an average of 36 minutes putting that interaction into the electronic health record. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So they're spending more time on their computers inputting information than they are in the patient interaction, mm-hmm. which seems terrible.
Yeah. Yes.
Like that's not what most physicians will say. This is not why I went to healthcare, so that I could sit in front of a computer after hours every day and input information.
Yeah.
And it leads to burnout and exhaustion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's because there's a lack of satisfaction. Job satisfaction mm-hmm. is one of the primary motivators of burnout, particularly in healthcare. I mean, this is why we see a lot of those people who I interview who are applying to medical school have been scribes. And so this is like AI being the scribe. Is that how it works?
Yes, you're getting into I just identified the problem, right? Like, there's way too much time being spent manually by the physician in the computer. So sometimes that's offloaded to scribes, but maybe there's an AI scribe that we could use. There are a bunch of companies right now that are using AI or training AI to listen in on the physician-patient meeting, the interaction. So that 30 minutes, it is transcribing the conversation, summarizing it, and inputting the relevant data into the electronic health record, all outside of what the physician manually doing it, him or herself.
Hmm. So it's almost like a court reporter sitting there and not only just like capturing exactly what is said, but then digesting it and trying to identify what is most relevant. So that like filtering process is a little bit uncomfortable, I would say.
Well, yeah, I mean, you'd have to really trust it. So you'd have to work with it quite a bit. But the idea is it would highlight all the pertinent information, put it directly into the chart. It would queue up prescriptions and insurance claims. So it would say, in the interaction, you mentioned this drug or this medication. Do you want me to order it? And here's how, and then it would also set up the insurance claim.
Hmm.
The not so glamorous parts of being a physician.
Yeah, interesting. So the insurance part is fascinating to me. So it would go through and basically pull out like billing codes from the conversations and saying, can you also bill for this? Can you also bill for that?
Yeah. So it would go through those ICD codes. It would do billing. And there was a New York Times article a few months back about a physician who was really despondent about getting rejected from insurance companies for the treatment plans that he wanted to enact with his patients. And so he had AI write the letter to the insurance company, and he went from about 20% approval to 80% approval.
Oh my goodness. I wonder if that's just a matter of using the right keywords or the key identifiers or framing it in the right way in order to meet the whatever reviewing. But who's to say that it's not AI on the other side, on the insurance company side, evaluating all of these things, right?
It is. Yeah. So that's happening as well. Mm-hmm. Physicians are using this to write the letters, and then insurance companies are using AI to read the letters. So I was talking to one AI programmer who's doing some of this scribing programming, and he said, that's fine. Like, that doesn't bother me I'd never thought about it in this way before. He said, when I think about like what I'm trying to program, I think what is toil for the, you know, sake of toil, and what is actually important. And we should offload all the toil. Like, we should not be having physicians do stuff like fighting with insurance companies. You do that for the purpose of getting your patient treated. And if AI can do that better, just let AI do it. Which I thought was good.
Yeah, I can see that. And I know a lot of my colleagues who are in, you know, clinical practice spend a lot of time arguing and petitioning and working with insurance companies to get stuff covered that they think is important.
Yeah, so if the AIs want to fight it out, let the AIs fight it out. And if it helps improve, you know, acceptance of the plan, then great, all the better.
Yeah.
The hope is that AI scribes will offload a lot of the electronic management, so clinicians can focus on their patient care. Of course, the history of medicine tells me that if you had an extra 4 hours in your day, you would love to spend that on patient care, like direct patient care, and your healthcare system might want you to just see more patients.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe the efficiency will be gobbled up in just working more and more and more. So
yeah, which wouldn't be great, but
yeah, I can see pros and cons of both of those, but it definitely takes out the human element of it. But how much different is it really than electronic medical records or using scribes or using kind of boilerplate documents that get reused? I think in some ways, these just seem like tools to increase efficiency in healthcare, which I'd be hard to argue against, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly what they are. So you're spending so much time inputting information. Apparently, the average primary care physician spends about 12 hours a week drafting and submitting prior authorization requests.
Oh my goodness.
That's so much time, right? So you do want to regain that efficiency. And the electronic health record itself was meant to be a system that gained efficiency, but it turns out it didn't. So we're actually spending more time documenting now with the electronic health record than we did when people were just writing things down in the chart. So
yeah, You know, maybe the electronic medical record was just a like a proto tool, an early tool that tried to be more efficient, but maybe AI is the next step to actually increase real efficiency.
Totally. Yeah. So maybe it could. I mean, I think there's going to be all sorts of questions about privacy. So it turns out that the bigger companies that are owned by the mega tech companies that are doing this work are just like getting all the information about, like, some of the programmers can actually see the interactions between the physicians and patients, which feels like a huge violation of their privacy.
Yeah. Yeah. Particularly if you're talking about, like, I mean, not to name names, but like Google Health, for example, has access to tons and tons and tons of data. It would be shocking to me if that type of data was not being used to at least train or develop some of these AIs for specifically for healthcare, right? And then questions about if I'm very concerned about my privacy, can I opt out of that? Or is that just kind of part and parcel of being seen by that provider in that system?
Right, right. So you say, okay, I'm going to use this AI scribe, or maybe you don't say that, right? So that's a good question too, is like, do you let people know that you're, do you let your patients know you're using this? Do you not? You know, what if they find out and you didn't tell them and they feel like their privacy's been violated? Can the companies really keep this information safe? Can we imagine that there's, you know, somebody could get access to people's sensitive health information, and there's lots of stigmatizing diseases out there that, you know, could be associated with folks that makes people very nervous, right?
Yeah. Yep. For very good reasons historically, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like there's never been a scandal or a problem about health information being used against somebody in very terrible ways.
Yeah. Okay. Here's the last one.
Okay.
And then I think in our next episode, we can talk about all the ethical controversies that have arisen from this kind of work. But here's our last kind of potential use. The last is triage and allocation of resource management.
Okay. This is a topic close to my heart. I love talking about a good resource allocation schema.
Yeah. So remember COVID?
I do.
Remember how hard it was to both like triage and figure out like who got what essential resources when we knew so little about COVID in the early days.
Yeah. Yep. And not just COVID as a disease and a disease process, but also all of the medications and vaccines and treatments that were being tried, you know, who had access to those, like remdesivir, for example, was a medication that was thought to be a game changer, didn't actually end up being that much of a game changer, but there was a lot of focus on how do we allocate these novel experimental therapies and medications ethically or appropriately.
Totally. And, you know, like even vents, that like ventilators that we assumed would really help people, who's going to benefit the most from them?
Yeah. So the idea would be to use AI to predict which of the patients would benefit most from these particular resources or medications or devices that are in short supply.
Absolutely. Yep.
I can see some issues with that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Particularly like who gets to choose who is more deserving of this particular intervention. I mean, this is something that we've been going back to. We've been talking about in kind of big world bioethics since, what, the 1950s, once ventilators were invented and organ transplantation allocation stuff, all of these things. Yeah, I don't know that AI is going to fix that, because I don't think we even really know what questions are the most relevant questions to ask in these allocation processes. And I know that you've written about this a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that AI could do is perhaps by combing big data, better predict mortality rates based on, you know, the patient's medical condition, and then predict if they were given this particular medication based on past patients, are they more or less likely to survive? Yeah, it's not going to tell us about all the really important values questions that go into resource allocation. That we still have to input that kind of information.
Yeah, and that presumes like we can even agree on what the values are or what questions to ask or how do we evaluate, particularly in contexts of patients who have disabilities, for example. I mean, part of the big controversy when we were talking about early in COVID about the allocation, how do we allocate medications and access to ICUs and stuff, some of the early frameworks that were proposed had a very kind of anti-disability, ableist bias towards them that was kind of baked into it.
Yeah, it wasn't subtle. It was like, patients with disabilities will not be considered.
Right.
Sometimes it was like, patients with an IQ lower than, which is like, wow. Or sometimes it was slightly more coded, like, patients with a loss of reserve of energy. Like, what in the world does that mean?
Yeah,
there was lots of, like, baked-in bias to that. So we'd have to still struggle with all of that kind of stuff because that would be the inputs, right? Mm-hmm. Those would be part of the inputs.
Yeah.
But apparently AI is already being used with, like, what's called patient flow management. So predicting, like, what kinds of patients need to be moved from the intensive care unit to the floor or an inpatient rehabilitation kind of situation or can go back to the nursing home. So it's, like, trying to do discharge planning and moving people up and down based on severity by predicting where the AI thinks that they'll kind of take a turn for the better or worse.
Yeah. I mean, I can see that a little bit in like the flow, the process, the patient flow, like through a clinical, you know, setting. That makes sense. I think that there's a lot of inefficiencies that get built into not just like how somebody goes from point A to point B within the clinic, but also like even the design of the clinics, the architecture and the way the offices are set up and all that stuff. I think there's a lot of room for improvement that AI would probably be very helpful for.
Yeah. And triage management in the emergency room. So this is already kind of a thing that people have to try to figure out quickly. Like who is, so if you come in with a gunshot wound, obviously you take priority over somebody who's there because they think they have a severe cold, right? Some of that seems sort of obvious, but it's also like who's screaming the most, which is probably not the best predictor of who needs the most emergent care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also if somebody is absolutely screaming their face off in the emergency department and they get treated very quickly and they're no longer disruptive, that can aid in the care of other people as well, right? It decreases the distress on other patients. And so, yeah, some of those like interpersonal types of nuances, I think, might be, well, definitely will be lost if AI is the one that's controlling all of that. Because AIs don't get annoyed. They don't get, you know, they don't have a rough morning with their kids trying to get in and out of the car, right? And it doesn't impact them for the rest of the day, so.
Exactly, yeah. So for better or worse, right? So we always think of that as like the benefit of AI is that it doesn't get annoyed. But maybe because it isn't annoyed, it doesn't read the room very well.
Yeah.
So it actually might be a downfall of AI that it can't sort of read the room in that same way. It doesn't understand social interactions or it can't account for those in the same ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you should definitely, if you ever have to go to the emergency room and you think you're in a true emergency, just start screaming your head off is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Say, Tyler.
Yes. I've heard that that's the best strategy. So
yeah. Raise a fuss.
Yeah. This feels like just the tip of the iceberg though. Like, I mean, these issues with AI in healthcare, I think any time this tool is being contemplated and being used, there's a lot of ethical questions I think that are involved in that. But also, I think AI is just going to be permeated throughout so much of our society and so much of the systems that we are involved with. So I think there's a lot to talk about.
There is. In the next episode, we'll talk about kind of the biggest ethical challenges that AI seems to be raising when we're talking about these clinical applications. We've sort of touched on some of them, but there's a lot more to get into.
Yep. Yeah. So this is going to be an ongoing conversation and we're going to bring in some guests who are very well versed in this and kind of down in the trenches about it to help us walk through it, help us understand it, kind of deconstruct it a little bit. But yeah, this is going to be an exciting series of episodes.
And yeah, keep listening for more exciting, breaking AI controversies.
Awesome. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Bioethics for the People. We can't do it alone, so a huge shout out to Christopher Wright for creating our theme music and to Darian Golden Stahl for designing our logo and all of the artwork. If you're into what we're doing, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen. And if you're really into what we're doing, head over to bioethicsforthepeople.com to snag some merch.